Hello.
Hi, this is Hannah calling for Dr. Powers.
Speaking, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Okay.
So are you ready to go ahead and do the interview?
Sure, you tell me what you need.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you so much for your time today. So this information is going to be used for the replication manual, as you know. And do you have any questions about the interview before we start?
No.
All right. So I'm going to start with the background questions. It's going to ask about the history of your participation in planning the Wisdom of the Elders program. So the first question is, how was the idea for the Wisdom of the Elders program conceived?
Wow. Well, it actually came from Ifoma, and she had a project that related to narratives, interviewing elderly individuals, family members of those who dug the Panama Canal in Panama. And this was of interest to her, and she wanted to reach out to others in the Vanderbilt community who dealt with aging. And we have a geriatric education center. And she was aware of that, and we met basically and started talking. She talked about her work, and she asked if I would be interested in visiting her project, which she was starting to duplicate that same project from Panama in Murfreesboro, which has a large African American community. And she was very interested in people talking about their heritage, and she wanted to learn a little bit more about the elderly individuals in the Middle Tennessee area, and also a little bit about what we were doing to educate the public, educate students and trainees in many fields about aging. So we got to work together and actually did a presentation at the Gerontologic Society of America related to narratives. I had some parallel interest in the narratives that health profession students have before they actually start doing official clinical work. So these are kind of unstructured reflections, if you will, on the populations that they're exposed to. So I was very interested in their concepts of aging, intergenerational things, and there actually has been some work on natural language processing, machine processing of these unstructured narratives to pick out themes. And so that was actually the nature of what we presented at the GSA. And it's grown since then over perhaps 5 or now maybe 6 years. We've been working together, and now that she has a larger grant to fund this, she's gone into different areas, into educational design and other art, I think, and in creative areas. And but she's included a track on aging, which I'm happy to be part of, and we're in the process of working with yet another group of fellows to introduce them to medical interviewing and also analyzing some of their reflections. So that's kind of in a nutshell how we got together and what we're doing now.
Wonderful. Yeah, that was a very comprehensive answer. And it kind of gets into the second question I have, which is to describe the history of the program. So I guess there's anything else you want to add to that, but that was.
Oh, sure. Well, I can tell you a little more about what we're doing with the medical area in working with undergraduates and graduate students who are not health professions students. We realize that some information, some coaching, and even some role playing is helpful before they actually start to work with sick, often sick, elderly individuals. And so we generally have one or two orientation sessions with the fellows where we talk a little bit about what it's like to interview somebody who may not feel good or who may have some sensory impairment, can't hear you very well, or and also what it might be like to do a home visit for some of these interviews, which does happen. And we get feedback from them, and also go through what's now required, which is a bit of a barrier, but is able to be overcome, where these health to be interviewing people in the healthcare setting, you actually have to have some credentialing, some certification. And so Vanderbilt, and we also do this at the Veterans Administration, have a number of application materials that have to be presented before the fellows are actually given permission to interview. And so we walk them through that and help them. And then the next step of the process is to actually bring the fellows to some team meetings where they get to meet other members of the healthcare team talking about patients. And it might be in a hospital setting or it might be in a clinic setting. Then we actually then introduce them to patients that have agreed to talk, of course, that can communicate. And we give them a chance to get to know each other. Generally, a first visit will be very short, and it's often easier if, say, it's in the hospital. But then the fellows will follow up for that individual at home. They make arrangements if the patient is agreeable to that. And they often learn a lot, often become very attached to these individuals, and often will make some supplemental visits. That remains to be seen how many they'll do. The last group, I think, made three to their patients and learned a lot, talked a lot about it. And we're in the process of deciding how to analyze their written work, which I think will be instructive in terms of many of the first things we mentioned, concepts of intergenerational understanding, learning, and just basically, I think, communication perspective, I think, of a new learner as to how they fit into the picture of what the older individual is going through. One thing, please stop me if I talk too much. I'll tell you one more thing. The one thing we have found is that the learner, the student, feels like they're a bother. They're going to be intruding on the older person. It's quite the opposite. The older person just really adores having a younger person come talk with them, is very eager to talk about their situation, and it's actually very therapeutic to them. And so we try to emphasize that it's actually a two-way street. The learner is learning, of course, but they're also providing some very beneficial things to the older person. And we're looking for evidence of that, but we know from talking with the older individuals, I see them for many other reasons and follow up in the healthcare system. They love having these students come visit them.
That sounds like some really interesting work. I too have seen how working with the elders in Murfreesboro, they do tend to be very receptive to our questions. Yeah, so thank you for that answer. The next question I have for you is, why is the program important? Why is it important to exist? What do you think the most important work that the program does is?
I think we have a new field that we're all learning from, basically how to mine the narrative by whatever methods, qualitative or by machine learning or some sort of assessment of the learner after they've recorded their thoughts, and we're trying to decipher what is the content and how can we best display that. So there's it's a new field of learning, which I think is very important. The second is that we're dealing with generations. We're dealing with young people, generally 20 years old or less for the most part, who are dealing with folks who may be 50 years, half a century or more older than them. We learn about their reflections on the aging process is important. We know that there's a lot of stereotyping that goes on in the larger society that not only is detrimental to the older individuals, but actually to the younger populations as well, younger generations, because how do they age? How do they think about themselves? And how can we improve that? Many of us in the field think that we need to make the reflection on aging a community effort. In other words, we're all aging. We're all going to have certain needs. How can we make society better for all of us, not for just thinking about, I'm doing fine now. I'm in my 20s, yet this old person here needs some help. That's so unidirectional and so not helpful, I think, in the long run. But how can we make society better for everyone? And there's a lot of spin-offs of that, age-friendly cities, designing built living space to benefit different generations, just interactions between different generations. Should we cohort people? Should kids all be in one area, old people all in another? No, they like to see each other and get mixed up, and they actually benefit from that. And there are a lot of benefits, too, to creative work for projects, a lot of mentoring, a lot of experience, and a lot of information that can be transmitted both ways. Younger people are very good at new technology, which older people like. We had a project where we had younger students teaching older folks how to use the internet. Ha ha ha, we thought that they were going to email their grandchildren. Baloney, they did internet shopping. That's what they really like to do. Who would have thought that? And vice versa. There are examples, we haven't done it, but others have, Johns Hopkins, where they paired retired symphony musicians or lawyers or retired doctors with current medical students, and they did art projects together or writing projects, and really learned a lot from each other. So there's a lot that can be gained from analyzing and promoting narratives. So we think that the work is just beginning. It's very qualitative, and so that makes it hard to be exact, but that also makes it more creative and exciting.
Absolutely. So what sort of needs do you think that the Wisdom of the Elders program fulfills? And I know you kind of got at that in the answer to your last question.
Well, yes, as a person involved in the field of aging, this one project that we're involved in helps us get a window into intergenerational understanding and learning. It's also very clear from a more medical standpoint that when we deal with health profession students, they kind of come in to their training very fresh and very idealistic and very open to many things. And when they leave, they're not so much. And we wonder, what have we done? Can we prevent that? Can we help keep that fresh look? Can we bottle that spirit, that energy and creativity that we know they enter with, that sometimes is hard to see as they go further on in their training? And little is known about that, but I think that there may be some lessons learned from projects like this Wisdom of the Elders that could be beneficial to medical training in general, particularly as it deals with caring for the elderly. So that's actually my hook. That's why I'm involved in it. That's my number one reason.
That sounds like some very interesting work. So the next question, so you kind of talked about like the elders and the medical students. Are there any other populations that you think are targeted by this work, or do you think it's kind of just like beneficial to everyone? Can you just describe the population that you think the program targets?
Well, the benefits of the program go both ways, for the older individual as well as the trainee. I think as far as the target, the audience for the lessons learned from this, most definitely it's the educational community. But I think a close second would be, it might even have some policy implications. We know that, for instance, caregivers for people that have needs, could be handicapped kids, but could also be older family members, are very distressed, and there's not a lot of support for them. We know that the United States spends proportionately very little for home and community-based services, for caregiver support services. In fact, even the country of Mexico spends proportionately much more on these services than the U.S. does. We spend it all on very expensive specialty care, and that that has to change because caregivers are very distressed. They're in a poor position to advocate for themselves when they're working hard as caregivers. But one example is that employers tell us that people who have an older person at home, it might be a spouse, it might be a parent that they're caring for, take much more time off from work than young mothers with kids who are occasionally sick and they have to take a day off. So that's just one reflection. The other is that a person with cognitive problems, dementia, and impaired functional abilities, has an activity of daily living dependency, is at very high risk for hospitalization, for using a lot of services. And if we don't support the caregivers, those people deteriorate very quickly, and there's a lot of them in this society. So the caregivers aren't being listened to, nor do we have good services. So by providing information about what older needs there are out there, how to maintain health, and how to prevent further deterioration, I think that those can be very important policy information to help shape policy. And it might just be a very personal thing. If you're a representative or an elected official, if people in your if your constituents are having these issues, you have so many stories that you can tell them, and you can dramatize, you can personalize that, and I think that that's important. There's a group called the Age, it's called the Framing Initiative, they are actually working on aging and public's attitudes towards aging right now. It's being funded by many in the aging fields. The Framework Institute is the official name of it, and they're actually going to have a big public education campaign about what society feels about aging and what's the best way to describe the needs. And there's a lot of information in there that I think it's helpful for society in general. So that's a long extension from actually training individuals to interview older people, but I think it's a reflection of the kind of information that projects like the Wisdom of the Elders can generate and some of the potential uses of that information.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's huge potential. I see it too.
Uh-huh.
So the next question is, what would you say is the mission statement for Wisdom of the Elders?
I think that probably to focus, so the mission is to bring the generations together and to learn from the written word the narratives of the trainees.
All right. And then did you personally have any connections to the work done in Murfreesboro?
I visited and I participated in some of the health fairs. I did not work with any of the families involved, but some of the fellows, the students that I've worked with, did. And so they learned from that, and then I introduced them to some medical aspects.
All right. Mm-hmm. So the next part is going to be about the next part of the interview is going to be about planning and implementation. Mm-hmm. So kind of more like the work that you did on the project is like less and less about the goals of the project.
Uh-huh.
So the first one is going to be, please describe your role as principal investigator of the program.
Well, my role is actually FOAM is the principal investigator, so I am her able-bodied assistant.
Mm-hmm.
I helped her flesh out the medical aspects. So we actually developed a very small curriculum for the students, the fellows, and I agreed to supervise some of them and to do some of the the legwork to help make it happen, such as get the information about the credentialing and the certification that was required, and then to supply potential interviewees and then help with the debriefing, if you will, or the reflections that the students would have after, certainly the first, but after a couple of interviews. So that's the implementation part that I've been mostly involved with.
All right. And so please describe how you identified and located and screened any staff that you hired for the program.
Well, actually, Destiny did that for me. I did not interview them, but they criteria were that they be undergraduate or graduate students interested and willing to speak to older individuals. And then she did a wonderful job, and we have two graduate students who are very mature individuals who I've met with and I think will be very sensitive to a lot of the topics that we've talked about. And it would be complementary to some of their studies. The two that we're working with right now, one is is in a degree program for public health, and the other one is in a divinity school program.
Wonderful.
So both are very complementary to this project.
Wonderful. And so did you have any involvement in obtaining funding for the project?
Yes, I helped IFOMA write some of the I contributed to some parts of the application, and the descriptions that I've mentioned came out of that. We met a couple of times and tried to formulate our goals and our implementation to the format that the application required, and so I helped her with that, and also in a general form helped her with the evaluation component. There's not a lot of science, but a little bit that's required to be successful with a grant, and to also help put your findings together, and that's something that that I think I was able to assist with, because my background is a science background.
Wonderful. And did you play any role in designing the workshops that the participants in Murfreesboro did?
Not that one.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
All right. But did you play a role in getting the community involved in your program? And I know you've talked about extending the work to the Med Center.
Well, yes, I think I gave one of our first meetings was about resources. Who's interested? There's a senior center in Murfreesboro, and I think I helped IFOMA connect to the wider community both there as well as at Vanderbilt for the project. So I was more of a matchmaker.
So were you previously doing work with the elders in Murfreesboro before Dr. Wonkwo got involved with them?
Yes, not as specifically in Murfreesboro, but just in the Middle Tennessee area. So I knew some of the Murfreesboro resources.
All right. And did you have ideas for increasing the community involvement when implementing the program?
Sure.
All right. Do you have any that you would want to include in the project replication manual that you'd want to mention for other people trying to increase community involvement?
Sure. Well, I think that being involved with the senior centers was partly my idea, and there are many of them. There are actually a network of senior centers in the Nashville area, and the different schools at the university, I think, getting pharmacy, social work, nursing, medicine involved, and then also the Veterans Administration. That was not something that IFOMA initially thought of, but they've actually been very supportive. And we've also reached out and supported some other work through contacts. I'll give IFOMA the credit. I think someone has heard about the different universities, I think, have heard about this. I was contacted by a group from the University of Pittsburgh, And they actually wanted to interview bereaved families, of all things, patients who had died, and wanted to put together a story corps for survivors, family survivors of patients that had died in the intensive care unit. That's a big job. So we had to go through the IRB, but I was able to get contributions from the Nashville General Hospital, which involved interacting with Meharry, the VA, and Vanderbilt, so that there were enough families to interview. And so that has been recorded now, a narrative of a different sort, and is available to help support current families undergoing a stressful situation of a loved one in a critical situation. And that's an ICU web StoryCorps-based project, very much like the National Library of Congress's StoryCorps.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
All right.
So that was huge community outreach.
Absolutely. That sounds like quite an undertaking.
Yeah.
All right. So I just have a few more questions that are going to be about like reflection and evaluation. So the first one is, what were some challenges you encountered when designing and implementing the program that you didn't anticipate?
The need for certifying and credentialing the fellows before they could be involved with any individuals in the healthcare setting. That's a huge barrier, and it's only become more difficult each year. So that's very hard. Keeping up the fellows' interest and sustaining them through what sometimes is a six-week application process. So that's very hard. So what we've had to do is to adapt to that. We can't get around that, but we've given them the criteria that need to be fulfilled, and then we've run some training and support sessions through that time so that they kind of feel involved, even though they aren't able to see any real live patients yet. That's the hardest.
Yeah, sometimes those certifications and those things are
terrible.
Hard to deal with. So could you please, so you already kind of described how you overcame these challenges by adapting mm-hmm. to them, and I guess there's probably not much else.
No, you just have to wait it out. So we gave them we're giving them, that's actually, I got a message from Destiny, what we're going to do now, we got to wait this one out. I said, no, let's get them together. So we'll have at least two sessions for them during the downtime and let them know that they were on the clock while they did their applications. So that helped them. They were actually working, although it doesn't feel like it. But that is the one downer for this. So we have actually lost some potential fellows who didn't. They just decided to do other projects because this was too demanding. Last year we lost a number of them. So I hope we keep these two and that we can keep their interest through this period.
Yes, hopefully. And so the next question is, are there any ways we can prevent these challenges from occurring in the future?
I think the best for this, because we can't avoid the credentialing process, is just start as early as possible.
And then the next is, please describe how you evaluated the work of your staff.
Mm-hmm. The work has been of several forms. Part of it has been that I've worked alongside the individuals, and so I could give a verbal report, or I could write a report, but also what their written work is can be evaluated as well. So that's the second thing. And the third is actually unique to this program. We actually get feedback from the individuals that they talk to and interview, and that has been the richest feedback about how sensitive they were, how helpful they were to the particular individuals, and how eager they were to see them again, actually. And giving that information back to the students was something they didn't expect.
Mm. And then I've got one more question for you. Is there any other information you think I need to know in order to help write the replication manual?
Yes, you need a champion for each of these different sections. So I can only speak for the medical one. You'll need someone that is involved with seeing patients, has a bunch of patients, has access to a clinic or a hospital or a nursing home, wherever the source is going to be. So that could be a big barrier. And then also needs to be comfortable with fielding the questions. The students have all kinds of questions when they first start to see individuals in these healthcare settings. So you have to be prepared to, I guess, demystify the experience, explain what's going on. A good example would be in the hospital. They can be noisy. You can have the nurse come in and roll over and give them a shot. You know? They have to see that they're jumping onto a moving train, and so that can be frightening to them. So they need to understand what the context is, and then try to spend a little time with the patient. And it might get interrupted. Got to go for an X-ray, something like that. Or they might say, I just don't feel good now. My stomach just really hurts. Can we do this later? Or there may be some sensory impairments that need to be overcome. Find somebody's glasses or hearing aid or something like that. So the preceptor, there has to be a champion who can explain or overcome these annoyances and try to maximize the exposure and the experience for both the patient and the trainee.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been incredibly helpful.
All right. Unique anyway. Thank you. And good luck.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Okay.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye. You too.
Bye.